Session number 10179, Rule 2.
Which was the 17th MGB Flotilla, which at that time, when I joined the 503, it was down in Weymouth. She'd been doing her working up trials, and she was under command of a officer by the name Martin, who at one time was a racing driver, and he kept company with ex-Billy Cotton, driving Bucattis. The first lieutenant of the ship was named Andrew Smythe. I wasn't impressed with 503 when I went aboard there, but eventually I got it to my shipshape as regards being a coxswain. We joined the rest of the flotilla, which was in Dartmouth, consisting of MGB 502. Both boats being built by Camper and Nichols, and they were originally built for the Turkish Navy, and they both had Paxman Ricardo high speed diesel engines. I'd never served in a diesel boat before, and obviously it was going to be a new experience to me, i.e. smoking, fueling, which was one of the very dangerous things on a petrol boat, was that you were deprived, when you came in from sea, you were deprived of being able to eat right away, because one had to fuel up immediately, and it was a good hour and a half before you were able to proceed with any cooking on account of any fumes that may be lurking in the ship. But a diesel was totally different. Also in company with this flotilla was a C-class boat which had done valuable work, was MGB 318. And a Masby 36, which I am told was the original worker in this particular flotilla as regards clandestine operations. Having done a lot of working up along with Martin on 503 round a place which we knew was called Par Sand, down in Par, which was near Newling, where there's quite a good surf running there, a very, very dangerous surf, but would give us all the experience we wanted. From the training that we got, I obviously knew exactly what was to be expected of us. We started off with ordinary dinghies and finished up with the latest type, what we now call prams, either a pram 2 or a pram 6, the numerals denoting the amount of people that we could get in this particular craft. They neither had a stern or a bow, so in other words, they had a bow either end, if you wanted to call it that, or a prow, if it were the name given. But some of them we eventually used. We had a little 1.5 steward turner, but they didn't prove a success on the operations, because the least noise in going into an operation was the better. Although they tried to bring him into operation. We'd done all our training down in Par Sands and round Slabbercombe Bay and those places, and of course, I'd done a lot of visits to a place called the Elford Pass, which is amazing, because going into the Elford Pass, I was amazed to see a middle ground boy, though they're called Chesney's boy. And having dealt with this Chesney, who later on was shot in a German cemetery, a big 6'4" to 5" lieutenant, who joined Coastal Forces and had quite a reputation, they named this middle ground boy after him. But that is something that was passing.
Why did the Germans shoot this gentleman?
Well, it's eventually something I learned later on when I was in the prison service. He was wanted for murder of both his mother-in-law and his wife, who he'd killed. They were found dead in a bath somewhere down Kent. But he'd taken up a life, if you may deem it, as one as a buccaneer. He was trafficking dope round the Algiers and round there in a high-speed boat, and he was trafficking a lot with arms and various other things in Germany. And it was whilst in the German area that the police caught up with him, and he was chased from Germany into France and was actually cornered in a French cemetery and gunned down. A very wanted man, but what a way to end his life, having been well known in the C-class coastal forces.
When approximately was that, that he was gunned down?
In a French cemetery, I can't remember the name, but that would be...
No, but when?
Around about, that would be in about 1940, about 48, 49.
Sorry, I interrupted your story. Could you go back to it?
Having got into the Elford Pass, we had a wonderful partnership there, which was the Sunbeam. There was nothing in Elford. If anyone has been to Elford knows that there's two pubs, one called the Shipwright and the other called the Carpenter's Arms or something like that. But there we more or less practiced with various types of canoes and done our work and our trials from there down to Pra Sands. By this time we had a change of commanding officers. Martin had left us, and in his place came Mike Marshall, who was well known in coastal forces, having served with us both on D boats and had a reputation in being in action off the Dutch coast on 607 when his boat was shot up, and been in some real sterling actions. He was also, I believe, he was the commanding officer of C-class boat 327. But Mike Marshall joined us as a skipper. From that time on, things seemed to get moving. We'd done quite a few operations from Dartmouth to Plua.
Where's Plua?
Plua, which is in Brittany.
What kind of operations were
there? Many operations, including agents, and of course American airmen, and which had been shot down in France, and they, through the resistance movement and through the organisation, we were able to bring quite a number back from the French, from the Brittany coast. We operated from I would say late 42 to early 45, when most of our operations was a huge success.
This is to the coast of Brittany?
Yeah, this is the coast of the Brittany. I'll tell you where it is.
You say you're operating from Dartmouth?
Yes, our base in Dartmouth was a very old, what was once upon a time, obviously a private motor cruiser, rather a large one, but very dilapidated, was the Calorn. And Calorn was the one that we moored up alongside. But no time did we ever tie up at the quayside. We were mid-river, moored in mid-river, or tied alongside Calorn. This is where the officers more or less had their... they could bathe if they wanted to. The facilities were very, very poor indeed, but that was the ship we moored alongside. There was 318 and 502... 503 and Masby 36. It obviously proved inadequate, because later on we got the Westward O, which was an old paddle steamer which operated from round Weston-super-Mare somewhere. I believe it belonged to Campbell's at one time, but it was ideal by the mere fact that we had big sponsors either side or built into the paddles, where we could tie up alongside comfortably without damaging ourselves. And the facilities aboard the Westward O was one that we had a naffy, which we enjoyed using, a naffy canteen, and also we could get a shower aboard, and which would alleviate some of the miseries that can be caused aboard a small ship as regards hygiene, as regards washing and what have you.
How dangerous were these missions to Brittany Coast?
Well, one doesn't realise until you become older how dangerous they were, because obviously we set out in the round about the, I would say, the $1,800 or the $1,600, $1,800 in the evening, and made our way with no escorts at the time. By the way, we never had an escort, although we believe now and again we had air cover. We made our way towards what I know as the other side of Guernsey and Jersey, round about Rochdu lighthouse, towards, if you like, a place called Les Andrières or Penpol, that area, where we were going to the particular beach that we were going, which I know as Plua, but perhaps later on I'll be able to give it the precise name from a book that I've got. But anyway, this is the particular area that we worked in. They were dangerous by the fact that one wasn't communication wise you weren't allowed to give orders by shouting. That would be absolutely suicide. Everything was done quietly. In fact, on our run after we left the Rochdu lighthouse was done on a centred engine, which was obviously quiet, and the rest of the journey was done on that engine so as not to be detected in any way. To get into the particular place was absolutely, one would say, 100% navigational wise was excellent. We always carried either two or perhaps three, but always two expert navigation officers who weren't belonging to the ship's company but belonged to the organisation. One was a fellow that we used to call Titch Salmon. Obviously the word titch, he was so small that we had to have an extra duckboard for him to reach the compass to take fixes of where we were going. And believe it or not, the other fella was a titch as well, because his name was Fraser, and he was the brother of Ian Fraser. As you know, he's the one that got the VC for working in midget submarines. But their capabilities were excellent, par none, and they used to get us in this particular place where we were going. As I recall to you, we were very young and didn't realise the dangers that we were in. In fact, as a coxswain, my duty was to be on the bridge at all times, along with the commanding officer. And the idea was, naturally, that should we be spotted or should anything happen, we'd be away. When I say we'd be away, the idea of mooring a ship in that particular area, we had a grass line which we used as a cable for an anchor, and on the forward forecastle we had an axe, a very, very sharp axe, so that we could chop the grass line immediately and get out of it as quick as we could. It may sound a bit how can we say irresponsible leaving people behind us, but there was no time for that. The idea was to get out as quickly as possible and get away from the area where the operation was on. We had many scares by the mere fact that whilst on the bridge, I also had a walkie-talkie which didn't prove the success. If there was any message to be given from those lads that were in the boat, the crew, which was consisted of more or less the same people, it was always the first lieutenant, Andrew Smythe, who coxswained the boat, and either Abel Seaman Irons and Stoker Andrews, Wren, and others. They took the turn and taken these, what we called SN6s. SN6s were manned by a big sweep oar, and the idea of the sweep oar, if you look at these people that do a lot of surfing in Australia and those places, you can understand why you need a sweep oar instead of a rudder. The command of having a sweep oar is tremendous when you're riding in on very, very heavy surf and there's lots of rocks about. The life of the people in the boat depend upon the man who's manoeuvring with the sweep oar. Obviously the idea is to keep the boat head on right through the surf all the time, with a stern, obviously keeping the stern as square and as rigid as possible, with the sea breaking on the stern. Occasionally, more often than not, you'd get a stern wave coming over and give the helmsman a particular drowning and some of the crew, but eventually they got them on the beach and got rid of their agents, and we were always met by the same lady on this beach, or the lads were always met by the same lady. This was very successful as regards an operation. Relating back to what I was telling you from the bridge, I didn't know then, but I do know now, how dangerous it was. because just above us, if one could realise, when we operated there, it was pitch darkness, more or less. Nobody would expect any craft at all to approach this particular beach, which was a dangerous beach. And notwithstanding, above us was a German gun post and also a barracks, and we could actually see the door of the barracks being opened by Jerry, and you could see the light as he opened the door, perhaps for a second, and closed it. We could see that going on. We didn't know till after the war that above us was a bristling machine gun nest, and of course it was a very active barracks, and I was told it was manned by the White Russians. Also, I'm told that it was very dangerously mined, and the resistance party, Shellburn, it was known as a Shellburn operation, had a very difficult job indeed of bringing the number of people that we brought back to the country. We brought back a lot of airmen, American airmen, who had been shot down. They'd either been in fortresses or fighter planes or anything else, or any other type of plane that they were flying in those particular days, Lightning Lockies and various other things. These had been brought down to the Plour Beach, lived round about the area of Shelburne, with the great work done by the resistance people, and those people, as we know, the Shelburne Helpers. I never had the I never had the pleasure of actually going back there after the war, but I can tell you that after victory in Europe, after VE Day, some time afterwards, the three boats, 503 and 502 as we were known then, and 318, went to Penpol, and from Penpol we met all the resistance workers that we work with. And don't forget, we were so excited to meet them, and you must realise that although it was a daily operation to us, it didn't sort of mean anything to us at that precise time. In fact, I had a wonderful show with some of the resistance workers, some very, very brave men, and we stayed the night with them and had a bit of a celebration. From then, the next day, we went out to Les Andrières, near the beach where we worked, and we brought quite a lot of the people that lived in that area aboard the boat, which was very, very difficult indeed. Don't forget that some of these people were getting on, what I would call getting on. They must have been in turn their 50s, and very heavily built women, you know, and locals as well. It didn't mean anything at that precise time. It does now when I recall it.
So you were doing these Brittany operations even after the Normandy landings?
Yeah, prior to the Normandy landings, prior to the Normandy landings, they were eased off a bit. The last operation that we had was more or less to notify, without telling them what was really happening, was to notify them there would be a lull, there would be a spell in the operations, because obviously the landings were coming off. So it was after the landings that we went out more or less to see them. The landing in Normandy and those beaches, we paid a visit to those, by the way, from New Haven. We'd taken some of the French brass hats over from New Haven over to I think it was Sword Beach, one of those we took them over. But don't forget, we'd been visiting that area and along that coast long before the landings had ever taken place. Having completed all our operations in that particular area, and they found there was no further work for us to do, it was decided that the ships would reorganise themselves. We were sent to HMS Mount Stewart, which was a base in Tynmouth, and there we'd done a course of unarmed combat, close range weapons, and map reference reading, and really being left out on Dartmoor and finding our way back. We're absolutely fit for any job that was going to be designated to us. It whilst we were at Mount Stewart that we were designated into hotels like the Portland Hotel, which I was in charge of. We had members of the 503, 502 and other members who were going to join us later on, which I will relate as we go along. At the same time, they asked for volunteers, for those that would volunteer to go abroad. Obviously, there was a number of the amongst the three crews that didn't like the idea of going abroad. The consequences was that the three ships at that particular time, consisting of 503, 502 and 318, were mixed. In other words, each of the coxswains remained on their own boat. I remained on my particular boat, 503 as coxswain. Fred Smith, who was the coxswain of 502, remained on his boat, which was 502. Nigger Mole, the three badge coxswain, who was my devoted friend right throughout operations, my going ashore pal, his boat was deemed unfit to travel to the Far East. So it was decided that, which I said I would relate later on what happened to him. Anyway, the crews done a working up trial and then were, if you wish to say, were divided or split up into to make the crews of what we now know renumbered. 502 became 2002 under the command of Quade Mason, Lieutenant Quade Mason, who was a South African and was the original commanding officer of MGB 318. 503, which has become 2003, the commanding officer was the famous Lieutenant Mark Arnold Foster, and he took command of 2003. The first lieutenant on 2003 was a chap called Grainy Nichols, who I've met since after the war, and although I got half of my crew, I considered I didn't get the best half, but that's neither here nor there at the present moment. But we eventually got seaworthy and went down to Brixham to sort of get together. Now, joining us at Brixham was the remainder of the flotilla, which was the same type of boat which was built by Cambron Nichols, but was being used by Captain Brian Reynolds, who I've mentioned before, who was doing the Skagerrak run for ball bearings, but had changed his name from Captain Brian Reynolds and now became Lieutenant Commander Bingham. And I believe he had the Hopefast. They weren't known as MGBs by numbers, but there was the Nonsuch, the Hopefast, the Viking, and the Gay. The Gay Viking. There was another one anyway. They became 704, 705, 706, but they were numbered 2005, 2006, 2007, 28, and 29 was a special D boat which Marshall had taken over as commanding officer of this flotilla, which was going out to Chittagong and that area, Sumatra, and we were going to do the same type of operations out there.
Could you explain again what this ball bearing run to Sweden was?
Yeah. The fact that ball bearings was a very essential thing required in our factories for building tanks and various other guns and various other equipment which relied on ball bearings for smooth working. The ball bearings in the country were so scarce that it was vital that we got as many ball bearings from what we know. Part of what we know was one ship, I believe, or more, which was taken over because it was in a neutral country, and therefore you couldn't sail it out to England, and they were taking us in short supplies, I believe, with a lot of help from the Swedes and bringing them back to this country. They proved a huge success. These boats were manned, as I've told you, by Bingham and merchant naval men combined with naval personnel, and were a great success. They joined us to make up the flotilla to go abroad, as I said, to Chittagong and Sumatra, to work on the same lines as we were working before. Having got round as far as Brixham, having left Tynmouth, it was decided that because there was a big advancement, in fact, they dropped the I'm not quite sure whether they dropped the atomic bomb then, and there was a great change in what we were about to do. But Mark Arnold Foster, because of his knowledge in German language and everything else, he was sent to Wilhelmshaven to look after the light coastal forces that belonged to Jerry, which was German E-boats, R boats and everything else. He was responsible, in fact, he was responsible for designating of which boats went to which country. So many boats went to the Russians, so many to France, and so many to England, you know, various things regards dispersing the German light coastal forces. Having got in this place a commanding officer by the name of Freddie Bourne, we made our way to Aberdeen. It was whilst we were in Aberdeen that the news came about that the war had finished. It became VJ Day. No, the war had finished in Japan. We were gathered up there, obviously, to sail from Aberdeen, but this didn't materialise. Whilst we were at Aberdeen, I was away on compassionate leave. It was decided to send 2002 along with members like Brian Reynolds, or I shall call him Bingham, the engineer, the base engineer Hugh Coppins, Quoid Mason, who was the commanding officer of 2003, who had missed an investiture, had been called away to go to an investiture. Mike Marshall, who was my original skipper, who was now skipper of 2009, decided to take 02, as I will call it, 02, over to this particular mission. They were going over to Sweden to thank the Swedish government for all the assistance they'd given us during the operations as regards the Ball Bearin operation.
This was in May 1945.
That's right, May 1945. There was quite a few changes. In fact, the Sparker of 209 was asked to go along, and there was quite a few passengers aboard there. It was obviously going to be something great, because they were obviously looking forward to having a good time over in Sweden. They'd already been given a route from PA Williams & Co, which particular sea lane to take. The sea lane they were given had been used 24 hours by King Haakon of Norway, who had been escorted by two destroyers to return to his own country, and it seemed to have proved a safe route. But unfortunately, about 2 or half past 2 in the morning, they hit a mine, and it was